interesting conversation ahead. So my name is Hermione Steinfeld. I'm the Literature Festival Manager at Asian House, and I'm also going to be the chair for today's session. On behalf of the Bagley Foundation, the Arts Council, and Asian House, I want to thank you for all coming here. So, those who are unfamiliar, Elizabeth Pisani studied Chinese at Oxford University before working as a foreign correspondent for Reuters, The Economist, and the Asia Times across Asia, including long stints in Indonesia. She has an MSci in medical demography and a PhD in infectious disease epidemiology.
Well done. Do it a mouthful.
She is the author of The Wisdom of Whores and her most recent book, Indonesia, etc., which she'll be talking about today. So I've read the book and it's really, really great. It's kind of a travelogue about your thousands of miles across Indonesia, but it also combines a lot of the history, the politics. It felt like I learned so much, and it's got a really great mixture of kind of the formal stats, figures, stories about Indonesia, as well as your personal meetings, encounters, some that are mundane, some that are completely bizarre, some very touching. So it's a really, really interesting read. Right from the start, Elizabeth says that Indonesia is her bad boyfriend, which I just instantly drew me in because I've lived in China and I used to describe China as my abusive boyfriend because on any given day I would completely love it and come back to it, but the pollution, the traffic, the internet going down would drive me absolutely crazy. And so I want to go to this as the kind of the beginning. If you could tell me a little bit about your bad boyfriend and what a day was like, a typical day for you living there.
Well, I don't know how many of you have had bad boyfriends or bad girlfriends for that matter, but those of you who have probably know that there's no such thing as a typical day. That's the problem with a bad boyfriend. There's no typical day. Every day is wildly different and unexpected, and that's what's wonderful about him, and it's also what makes you want to slap him upside the head. So, Indonesia is good-looking. It's gorgeous. It's rich. Incredible natural diversity of natural resources. So rich and good-looking is always a good start, right, for a bad boyfriend. Utterly, utterly charming. Nicest people in the world. So easy to get around. I mean, I was travelling, you know, around places where no Indonesian friend of mine. So I'm sure you're all familiar, but this is Java, which is one of the 13,000 whatever islands, and this has 66% of the population. All crammed in here, so 180 million people just in here, and then and many of them, and especially the ones that live in the little middle class bubble of Jakarta, couldn't find most of these places on a map, let alone having been to them. So travelling around these places, there's no hotels or whatever, so you have to throw yourself on people's mercy. And I never, ever, ever, ever once, when I was walking into a new town or arriving on a boat at 3:30 or at 3 a.m, I never thought, oh my goodness, something bad could happen. Because it never does, because Indonesians are so kind and welcoming and someone will always take care of you. So that's the charming side of the bad boyfriend. You have all of these shared experiences which make you giggle quite a lot over time because it can be very absurd. But then it forgets important anniversaries, it reinvents its history, it tells endless low-grade lies about itself and everyone else, just like a bad boyfriend, till you know that it's all going to end in tears. But somehow you keep going back for more anyway. So a typical day in Jakarta is sitting in traffic and then going to incredibly dreary meetings with government officials who spend 70% of the meeting on completely meaningless formalities, and then when you get down to the substance, we'll say, whatever you think. Can we talk about the budget? That's a day in Jakarta, basically, and then you get back in your car for another 3 hours or on your motorbike or whatever. A day with a bad boyfriend in the Bangai Islands up here or over in Pulau Banyak can be going out fishing, hunting whales, for example, why not, in a wooden boat with 10 guys who are absolutely pie-eyed drunk and who have forgotten to bring any extra petrol, so that with a storm rolling in and you're coming towards the reef and the engine's running down, and you say, shall I just put down the anchor just to maybe keep us off the reef? And they say, anchor? Oh yeah, no, we forgot the anchor today. That's the kind of day with your bad boyfriend out in the other parts of Indonesia.
So the good bits, are those what led you to live there for actually more than any other country you've lived in your life, you've spent in Indonesia?
Yeah, it's mostly, I mean, the thing that just is so captivating is the diversity. And I've been very fortunate in almost all of my incarnations there. So I was first there as a reporter in the late 80s, early 90s. Then I worked for the Ministry of Health as an epidemiologist for 4 years in the early 2000s. And then I spent 2 years just doing this. And in all of those incarnations, I was lucky that I got to trail around and see quite a lot of the country. And it's that diversity that is just so endlessly captivating. And I think if you were trapped just in Jakarta, particularly, which is a rather difficult city to live in, I probably wouldn't have kept going back so much. But it's the diversity is just absolutely mind-boggling. And you know, the subtitle of the book is Exploring the Improbable Nation, because the fact that this actually hangs together as a country is something that is nothing short of miraculous. Not only as a country, but as an incredibly active, vibrant democracy.
Yeah, and that definitely
How
comes
can
across.
Not be interested. So,
every anecdote is just completely different from the last,
which makes it bloody hard to write about. Because, you know, I've got 36,000 pages of notes just from this journey and 20 years of history, and you're trying to say, okay, wait, I need to tell a story that's typical. There isn't, like, no typical day. There is no typical. So it's challenging.
So one of the bits in the book is, you know, you obviously speak about Jakarta, and you say that Greater Jakarta has 28 million people, the second biggest city in the world after Greater Tokyo, and that there's intense traffic, as you just mentioned, the bad boyfriend is very congested. But you also describe how they've come up with all these creative ways of dealing with this traffic, where they've fitted their cars with mobile offices, and there are people on the side of the road helping people work whilst they're in traffic.
No, it's better than that. It's even better than that. This is a classic Indonesian solution. So, terrible, terrible traffic. What are we going to do? New regulations. Because government regulations are always a good way of solving problems, right? We'll have a government regulation. Got a government regulation. What is it? We're going to only allow, on the very, very congested bits downtown, we're only going to allow cars that have at least 3 passengers. So you can't have only one person in the car. You have to carpool. And that's going to reduce congestion. So what happens, these people who are helping, they're not actually helping you do your work, they're helping you fill up your car. So they're called jockeys. And this happened within about 4 days of these regulations appearing. Suddenly, the loutage of Jakarta, the unemployed youth of Jakarta, which is about 14 million people, you know, all with bad haircuts, are suddenly out there on the side of the road, like this, helping you to sit in your nice air-conditioned BMW. So they're thrilled, because instead of, you know, hanging around under a bridge, they're in an air-conditioned car for hours, just going, and then they go to the end of the thing, and then they come back in. But then that you've got a bit of a bad reputation because there were a few kind of incidents. A couple of people got carjacked and that didn't work out very well. So now it's mothers and babies, because a baby counts as one person too. So now you see all of these women with their babies in a sling in the alley, standing by the side of the road waiting to take up space in your BMW. It's fantastic. It's such a brilliant solution. Of course, the traffic just makes the traffic work. I mean, it doesn't help the traffic problem at all. But it gets around that pesky habit that, you know, that the bureaucracy has of making regulations.
Yeah. So I'm not going to bring everything back to China, don't worry, because we're here to talk about Indonesia. But I remember in Beijing, they have to deal with air congestion. They said that if you had a number plate, like half the alphabet could only drive on certain days. And so then within about 5 days, sure enough, everyone had a fake second number plate and they just switched every night. And what I think is interesting is that in China, there's this kind of this cliche that people say about China that they're not creative. Just let's forget the fact they invented paper, etc. But the modern Chinese are not creative. And I wanted to hear your take on the creativity in Indonesia, because you really admire this kind of inventiveness that comes out.
Yeah, I mean... The creativity tends towards the labour saving.
Okay.
The creativity tends towards something that will remove the need for you actually to put much effort into something. So the most fantastic thing I saw, I was in Aceh-Singkil, which is over here. It's a Malay-speaking part of Aceh, which is mostly Achenese-speaking. And I was staying with a family of... So the father, the patriarch, was a retired school teacher who told me this fantastic story about having to tell stories about... make up numbers for the British Council. But that's a different story. And his son was a school teacher who didn't really go to school very much because what's the point, and it's raining and it's far away and whatever. And so he didn't go to school very much because that was quite a lot like hard work. But he was so inventive that he and his wife had a young baby, and... Indonesians very often put their babies in these slings that are on big coils, big springs. So you just, every time someone walks past, they give it a tug and it kind of goes up and down. It's like a kind of rocking a cradle thing, which is already a brilliant idea. So you just, someone. But he's made a machine, this incredibly elaborate thing. It's a big frame and it's got an old bicycle chain and a bicycle wheel and a little motor. And it cranks round so that it permanently bobs the baby up and down. And they're running this off the generator in the house because there's no electricity supply, you know, rather than just sit nearer the kid and go like this every now and then. No, he's made this machine. And it was a brilliant invention. It was absolutely fantastic. You think, gosh, if you'd taken that level of mental energy into the classroom and taught the kids, you know, about it, about it, might have been a better use. But hey.
And that is one of the things that really comes out in your book, is that Indonesia has the largest number of teachers per children in the world, I think. High attendance rates right the way through to secondary school that really are on a par with most of the best educated countries in the world. But at the same time, outside Jakarta, shockingly poor teaching, terrible grades, teachers don't turn up to classes.
Yeah, I was in the Bangga Islands up here, and I was staying with a fisherman, and his wife, after supper, very proudly showed me her teacher ID card, and it was a card that showed that she was a government-employed teacher, which is like the highest rank of teacher, and I was duly impressed. And I said, who did she teach? Oh, she's a grade one primary school teacher. And all over Indonesia, primary school starts at 7 o'clock. And the following morning, we're up at about six and we're having breakfast, chat, chat, chat. She's frying the coffee, and then she's frying plantains for breakfast, and the kid comes in his uniform, ready to go to school. It's getting to like 6:45, and she says, "Don't be late," and he goes off. She hasn't had a shower or anything. She's still frying her plantains. And neighbor comes in ostensibly to discuss some program, but actually to, you know, have a look at the strange foreigner who apparently, rumor has it, all around the town, drinks empty coffee. That is coffee without sugar. So that's actually worth coming and looking at, because, wow, never seen that. So then I sort of say to her about 7:10, I say, "So what time does school start in Pobuzi?" And she says, "Well, everyone knows I've got guests." And I thought, oh my God, she's not going to school because of me, you know, because I'm sitting here, and that's terrible. Because, so I said, you know, I don't know if any of the kids have English class this morning, but if you wouldn't mind, maybe I can go along with you to school and help out the English teacher and whatever. She looked really relieved. She's like, yes, great. She went lightning quick shower, and off we went to school. And we arrived at about 7:40, I suppose. And there were 123 kids running around, screaming their heads off. 11 teachers in the school of 123, which is, you know, a very good teacher-to-student ratio, except that not one of them had showed up. Not one of the 11. Not one. And I said, you know, how often does this happen? And she says, oh, well, you know, I'm usually quite, you know, I try to. She took it quite seriously. Then in one of the other, the school, she telephoned the school head, saying, we've got visitors. And the school head turned up at about 10:30 or 11. That was it for the morning. So you've got all of these things that look really good on paper, but then you're asking kids of 7-year-olds, so you're asking classes full of 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds to go and sit nicely and study by themselves in the classroom. The current Minister of Education, this guy called Anis Baswedan, he's a very interesting character. He was the youngest ever head of a university in Indonesia. And he started a program called Indonesia Mengajar, which is it's sort of like a VSO or something like that, a volunteer program for kids from the very best universities in Indonesia who've just graduated from University of Indonesia, from ITB in Bandung, whatever. They go off and teach for a year in these places, and I actually came across a bunch of them in several places where I went, over here in Tanimbar, up in Sanger, over in Bulabanya. Like, so I ran into these kids, and in Tanimbar I ran into a woman who was teaching in a very, very out of the way village, and she said, you know, I feel so bad because I know there's no such thing as a stupid child, only bad teachers, but I find it so difficult to teach some of these kids. And I had to say to her, you know, in this area, you've got 40% second-generation malnutrition. There is such a thing as a stupid child, you know. There's such a thing as a hungry child and a child who is chronically malnourished. And it's an incredibly fertile country, so it's, you know, it's because of mismanagement of resources rather than lack of resources. So that's, you know, some of the frustrations, some of the times that I want to hit the bad boyfriend upside the head is when you see things like that, this sort of mismatch between the potential possibilities and what actually gets realised.
So with some of the teachers, they are just getting despondent because the children are not quite as clever or as well behaved or something. But I'm guessing for not all the teachers, like what is kind of, why are the teachers, why aren't they taking it more seriously?
Well, so... In outside of Java, so 84% of the manufacturing private sector economy basically is concentrated in Java here, in this one island, which has 66% of the population, but that leaves a lot of people in areas of the country where there's essentially no industry, where there's essentially no private sector. So the only formal employer, there's lots of informal employment, but the only formal employer is the state. So everyone is dying to become a civil servant in those parts of the country. Now, Indonesia politically is really, really interesting at the moment, because it went through the Suharto years, through the 33 years that he and the military essentially ran the country up until 1998. It was very, very centralized, so everything was dictated by Jakarta. And then since then, it's decentralized radically, massively. So now everything is run at the level of the district, and there are over 500 districts. And every one of those districts has its own health department, education department, you know, justice department, everything. And so one of the, and every one of those 500 districts has a elected head. And that's one of the most important and powerful positions in the country now, is to be a bupati or a walikota, an elected head of a district. And they get elected basically by the people of their ethnic group, and the payoff is that they then give jobs and patronage, contracts, whatever, to people who've supported them in the elections. And the easiest form of, the easiest thing that you have to give out in terms of patronage is a civil service job, and the easiest entry point for a civil service job is a teacher. And so an awful lot of the people who become teachers are there because they want the uniform, because they want the civil service card, not because they have any interest in teaching, in kids, in education, in anything else. So I think that that, in large part, accounts for the very, very low kind of motivation. But also, there's just... culturally, it's hard to talk about culture, to use the word culturally, in a country that has 300 and some ethnic groups, obviously. But in the Javanese culture, the dominant culture for most people, it's very hierarchical. There's not a a great tradition of challenge, of inquiry, of this or that. So in the office of the head of that school that I was talking about in Poipisi, on the very, very top shelf in her office were two rather wonderful anatomical models, a female, male and female, and you could take out the organs and you could do this and that. There were three big globes, and in the corner there was a forest of maps that were all neatly rolled up and around their poles and in their plastic. None of these things had ever been opened. So they're all there, they've been sent out by the system, but none of these things are being used. And in one school I went to, up in Hulu, which is one of the poorest schools I went to, they had this fantastic volcano model, interactive volcano model. And you could press a button and the lava would flow and you could see it coming up through the chambers and this and that. It had never been taken out of the box. And you can, I mean, for kids in a place where there are no toys, there are no anything, to have something like that to play with, you know, they'd learn so much. And I said to the school teacher there, "What, you know, why don't you use this?" And she said, "Well, the kids might ask questions."
Oh, God, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and you think, oh, yeah, no one's ever told the teacher how to use these things. How to, you know, these. So there are efforts that are going on. There's a lot of in the decentralization, and some schools are doing much better than others. It's very district based. So yeah. It's not, you know, it's not universally, you know, bleak. But in the outer islands, yeah, creative thinking is not something that is inculcated at a young age. That's fair to say.
But one thing that seems a little bit more universal is this antagonism towards Malaysia, that lots, for lots of the youth, you know, you mentioned flag burning, tweeting hashtag I hate Malaysia. Can you expand on this and also generally, you know, kind of nationalism, national pride, religion, these kind of various ways that people are identifying?
So as I say, Indonesia is a country that really logically shouldn't exist. You know, it's an amalgam. Just the scale, the sheer scale. So if this is, I'm sure you all know this, but it's, I just remind myself of this all the time. If you put this at London, then this is Tehran. You know, it's an amazing sweep of geography with 13,000 islands, about 7,000 inhabited islands, with all of these different ethnicities. People say it's the largest Muslim country, but actually it's not, because it's not technically Muslim. So yes, it is home to more Muslims than any other country. It's the largest Muslim majority country, but there are six official religions, and you have to choose one off the list. You're not, atheism is not allowed, but it's multi-religious, it's multi-ethnic, it's very, very multi-linguistic. So what does it mean to be Indonesian then? And unfortunately, Indonesians are not very good at sport, because that would be if they had a fantastic national team, except for badminton, which is badminton and tax evasion are the two national sports of note. But there's not, you know, a national football team or something that brings everyone together in that way. So people generally only express their Indonesian-ness in opposition to something else, and only when they feel under threat. Recently, I'm sure you've been seen in the news that there's been a bit of a controversy about the execution of a number of mostly foreigners for drug dealing. And that's been a very controversial issue, because a number of the countries whose nationals were to be executed made representations to the government saying, please don't do it. And so it became an issue of sovereignty. You know, it's our law, we do what we want, this and that. And especially the Australians really get up Indonesia's nose. And it's at times like that that you get this response of hyper-nationalism. But actually, it's really very, very rare. And it's only when there's some need to come together around something that you get that sort of slightly xenophobic feeling. But in fact, Indonesians are naturally incredibly, incredibly open. If you think about it historically, so you've got India up here and China up here, right? Well, those are the two great powerhouses of production internationally, globally, since the beginning of time, practically. And until just about 200 years ago, the only way to get goods between those was either to schlep them over the Himalaya, not a great idea, or to take them by sea. And if you took them by sea, you took them down through these islands. And because you've got the equator going through here, and you've got the trade winds going back and forth, so the trade winds blow one way half the year and the other way the other half of the year, you've essentially got a natural conveyor belt for trade through these islands since the beginning of time. This was never a nation. This wasn't a nation until 70 years ago. So everyone is constantly meeting outsiders. They're now all Indonesians, potentially, but you were meeting people from Seram, we're meeting people from Buru, we're meeting people from Bhutan, we're meeting people from... You've got this flow of people. So everyone is very open to outsiders. Occasionally you have, you know, the need to get stroppy, and then we get stroppy either with Malaysia or with Australia. But it's pretty rare.
And with this kind of this gigantic nation that's London to Tehran, and the kind of how that they weren't a nation until 70 years ago, I'm wondering about this kind of this imagined community. It seems that Indonesia's got to be one of the most classic of the imagined communities, bringing all these people together who are leading these completely different lives under one banner. To what extent has the ubiquity of TV and social media, which is huge, I mean, they're some of the biggest users of social media in the world, how has that been a godsend for uniting everyone?
It's an interesting question. Let's start with TV, because that was came much earlier. TV's always been used quite politically in Indonesia. And it wasn't until, so in the mid-80s, Indonesia put up a satellite. The only two countries at the time that had satellites that covered their whole terrestrial area were the US and Canada. So that a country like Indonesia would put up its own satellite, Balapa it was called, was, you know, quite a big statement, both of their aspirations to kind of be a world player, but also of their determination to pull the country together. So Suharto did that basically so that he could beam TV shows across the nation. And the idea, so in the early years, there was only one national station, TVRI, and there was a lot of kind of, you know, cultural dancing, and there was a lot of that stuff that you get on those rather old-fashioned, we're going to be a happy nation of togetherness by accepting one another's diversity type thing. But then things went a bit belly up with Suharto's regime, and he kind of abdicated a lot of responsibility for the economy to his children, who were both stupid and greedy. And they decided that they were going to throw away a law which banned advertising and foreign content and flood the nation with the Sinetron. The Sinetron is the soap opera. And so first of all, they imported all of these... there was Dallas for a while. I remember watching Dallas way back when in the late 80s, early 90s. But mostly it was... Mexican and Brazilian sinetrons. But then, brilliant Indonesian creativity yet again, they thought, we can do this better. You know, we've got the concept, we've got the storylines, we can do this better. So now there's an incredibly active Indonesian sinetron thing. But the storyline is basically always. So I was over here in Timor and with my brother, who is about as opposite to me as you could possibly get. So he lives in a small town in upstate New York, never goes anywhere, had never been to Asia, this or that. Just before I left Indonesia, the penultimate time, he came to visit me. And I took him like way out in the boonies, and we were on our way to somewhere. We were in a warung having our supper, and as usual, television blaring in the background, and it's a sinetron. And my brother starts translating, right? So he's watching it. I've got my back to it, and he starts translating what's going on. Oh my goodness, how can he prefer that little strumpet to me, his faithful wife? Well, if you know, and he's giving this whole running translation, and I'm hearing it, and kind of, and then I think, hold on a second. My brother doesn't speak a word of Indonesian. So how is he doing this translation? Oh, because it's the universal storyline, the universal language of sinetron. But what's interesting about this is, to answer your question, you think I've drifted far from it, but no, I'm still on topic. To answer your question, it's actually showing the life of a very, 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 very small, entitled, privileged Jakarta elite. But it's like Dallas. It's like watching... there are people here who are old enough to remember the soap opera Dallas, right? There are probably people here who are too young to remember it. But, it's a soap opera about an incredibly hyper-privileged class of Texan squillionaires. Be like showing that and thinking that that is the American experience, you know. So you're showing these sinetrons, and people who are in these islands here, who don't have electricity, but they have a village genset generator, and the village genset has a timetable, and the timetable is the exact hours of the sinetron. So, which are by Jakarta hours. So the genset gets switched on the minute of the first sinetron, and then the whole village is there, like this, and you think, oh my God, all this pap. And then after 2 days, you're like this. It's compelling, completely compelling. I got totally hooked, of course. But everyone is absorbing this vision of an Indonesian reality, which is very, very, very far from their own. So is it a force for unity? Well, everyone's speaking the same language, there's that, but people never find themselves reflected on the screen. People in the outer islands never find themselves reflected on the screen. So I think that there's a real duality there. Same thing with social media. So there are 73 million internet users in Indonesia, and there are 72.8 million users of social media.
Oh, wow.
So basically, every internet user in Indonesia is on social media. Anyone who accesses the internet at all accesses it to go on Facebook. Almost all of them are on Facebook. The Facebook numbers are 68 some million. And then there's a lot of tweeting and et cetera, et cetera. That, the more the tweeting and the hookup apps and those things are basically exclusively in the large cities of Java. So is that bringing people together, or is it making them more aware of their differences? I'm not sure. I think it's a really... a lot of academics working on it now, actually.
So watch this space.
Yeah, I think it's a real watch this space. I think that the possibility... You get a very... So as I'm sure you read, social media was a very big part of the last presidential campaign. So it was a big election last year. Very exciting. Very nerve-wracking. And there was a sort of... one contender was from a very well-established tradition of military, used to be married to the daughter of the former president, etc., etc. And the other contender was a real outsider, completely chaotic campaign, very badly organized, etc., but mostly run by volunteers, really, really active on social media, incredibly creative uses of social media in a way that did engage quite a lot of people. So I think there's possibilities for it to be used in a way that ties people together more, but right now I'm not sure that that's the case.
Interesting. I'm going to open up soon to the audience, but I just want to ask a few more questions. You just mentioned hookup apps. In your book, you describe a woman called Sana, and you say that she's wearing an outfit that is a classic Javanese mix, unimpeachably modest, but undeniably sexy. So, you know, how sexy is Indonesia? You know, there's the conservative aspects that you see, the huge amounts of religion, but what is going on beneath the surface?
That question's never been asked before.
Especially never to me, right?
Yeah.
I used to work, in my work for the Ministry of Health, I worked on HIV surveillance. So I spent a lot of time in brothels and nightclubs and karaoke bars and whatever. So I probably have a slightly distorted view of the size and reach of the sex industry. But there's a very large industry. And there's there are incredible double standards. So one of the most popular forms of music is dangdut, which is a kind of mashup of Bollywood and techno in a way. It's kind of, you can tell from the name, the beat, dangdut, dangdut. It's very, but the famous dangdut singers are incredibly provocative in their dress, in their presentation.
And this is women?
And women, yes. But it is thoroughly, thoroughly Indonesian, right? So you can't say, oh, that's foreign muck that's being imported to pollute our youth. It's very Indonesian. And it's very, very, very popular. And it's especially very popular at political rallies. So one of the things about politics is much more interesting in Indonesia than here for many reasons. So the election here last week, how dreary. We'll leave aside the results. How dreary was that? I went to my polling station. No one offered me a chicken dinner. There was, nothing fun happened at all. There were no great rallies with pop stars and whatever. So in an Indonesian campaign, you've got all of these rallies, and it's really exciting, and the big parties will hire, at immense expense, these pop stars to come and give concerts and etc. And the
PKS, which is the most, which is the Prosperous Justice Party, which is modelled on the Muslim Brotherhood, it's the most overtly Islamist. It's not really Islamist, but it is the closest to being an Islamist party of all of the political parties. And who do they have at their campaign rally but a really famous Dangdut singer, you know, who's there drilling away and, you know, dancing really sexy. And you're like, okay, well, you know, it does not compute. So there's a lot of... There's a lot of difference between the self-perception at the national level, morality being front and centre, you know, silliness like recently they banned the sale of beer in mini markets throughout Indonesia because the presence of beer was disrupting and creating the corrupting the youth, etc. They've banned the sale of condoms in the city of Surabaya, which until recently had the biggest red light district in Southeast Asia. Why? Because the availability of... Actually, they haven't banned the sale, sorry. You can get condoms if you are over 25 and married. Which is doubtless when you need
them. Okay,
so
wait, they want you to be pregnant when you're not married. They want you to not use condoms they want you to just not have sex before you're married.
Obviously, the availability of condoms makes you go out and have sex. Did you know that?
About halfway through. About halfway through your travels, you get bored of people asking you that you don't have kids.
Yeah.
And so you said you had two, and then suddenly it's in the newspaper that this journalist with her two kids.
Yeah, no, it's...
So is there this kind of this pressure to conform to this heteronormative role? And then where do people in the LGBT community, what's happening with these people that aren't having all their kids?
There is massive, massive pressure to conform. And the pressure is not so much a pressure, this is my perception, the pressure is not so much based on morality. It's not so much that it's wrong to be gay or to be trans or whatever. The pressure is more that Indonesia is, I think its most fundamental quality is a sense of community, starting with the family and particularly the keluarga besar, the big family. It's a very, very, very communal place, in the best possible sense, I think. I think in the best possible sense. But that does create a huge pressure to be part of this community, conforming to this community. One of the things that drove people most crazy about me was that I was alone. That I was, when I was travelling, was that I was alone. And people kept saying, "Kosandiri, don't you have any friends?" I get asked that hundreds of times a day. "Don't you have any friends?" I was like, "I've got plenty of friends. They're just not with me, you know." But that was that whole, the idea of being all alone and without your support networks and without your family networks and whatever is very threatening. So, so I've done a lot of work, particularly with transgender sex workers, male sex workers, and in the gay male community, and in all of those communities, interestingly, especially in the trans community, there's a huge pressure to people. People want to, gay guys plan to get married and have kids
with.
With a woman.
With a woman, okay.
Because that's their contribution to life, society, whatever.
Yeah.
Who they have sex with, different story. That's changing now a little bit over time. But interestingly, several of my gay friends who are kind of out there on the much more open, much more out, living in couples, they've all adopted kids. So that the unit of the family and the whatever is still very, very strong. And I think it's that is the cause for it. And as I say, the Wadia, the transgender community, are very, the ideal is to get a husband for transgendered women. The ideal is to have a husband, and okay, people will work quite hard to recreate the family structure that they kind of ran away from.
So yeah, it's kind of in a way performance, you know, as long as you're performing a certain part to not disrupt this community, you can do what you want behind the scene.
Exactly. And that's true a lot of Indonesian cultures, particularly Javanese culture, is very performance based. Politics is very much about the show, and that hence the big rallies, the big you'll be in some place in the middle of absolutely nowhere, you'll be coming on a ferry up to, where's an example, up to here or up to, I mean, these tiny islands that you can barely see on the map, and you've been on the ferry. So I, for example, from here to here is 5 days and five nights on a cargo ferry. So you're sitting on the deck, and every now and then you're coming into an island, and you start to recognize this pattern. It's really funny, because with this decentralization, you've suddenly got all of these little districts. So this, where's Sabo? I don't have my glasses on. I can't find it without. Here, this little tiny island here, which is, you know, the size of Kensington with about probably a 20th as many people, is its own district. So now you're getting in the boat, you're coming into these places, and the first thing you see is, on the horizon, you can see, oh, there's an island. Oh, we're coming to an island. Oh, how nice, maybe I can get something to eat. And then the next thing you see is a cell phone antenna. Brilliant cell phone coverage throughout this whole nation. And then the next thing you see is this white smudge halfway up the hill. And that white smudge is the politician's palace. The new head of district, the very first thing the head of district does is take $20 million from the budget and spend it building this gargantuan palace for himself. And that's for one person. Then you have all of these, you know, you have a different building for every unit of government. But these things are, and you think, wow, we're actually just recreating the sultanates. We're basically recreating the pattern that existed pre-Dutch involvement, pre-European involvement in Southeast Asia, which is that you've got a number of quasi-independent fiefdoms run by people who are a lot about pomp and show and display of power. So that whole symbolism is, I think, something that goes through from family life, politics, right through Indonesian life.
I think this is a good place to invite the audience in. So, question right away.
That was a really interesting point, actually. But my question is, picking up on this sense of community in Indonesia, what are Indonesia's abilities to be a sense of their place in the region, bearing in mind that they often feel that the rest of Southeast Asia is irrelevant to them, and the only places they need to care about are China and India, and by the way, we're about as big as them, or if we aren't already, we will be soon. We don't need ASEAN, we couldn't have shaped up the nations. This community consciousness that you just described, where is Indonesia at now? What is the sense of where it is in the world?
So I'm going to have to disagree with you about them actually caring even about China or India or... I mean, I had this disagreement recently with...
I hardly answered the question.
Yeah. Honestly, most Indonesians do not think about the rest of the world. Almost at all. There's virtually no Indonesian diaspora. I mean, truly, compared to, do you agree with me?
Well,
or not?
Huh? I think we have an Indonesian diaspora.
Yeah,
Indonesia.
Yeah, no, obviously.
But it depends, really. I guess it's it depends on where you believe. Like, if you believe in Jakarta with education and stuff, you would care about it. But if you come from different parts of the country, which, yeah, very uneducated.
Right.
So, yeah, you don't care.
But I don't... so I've thought a lot about this, about why even in Australia, you know, there are 60,000, that's the closest neighbour besides Malaysia, 60,000 Indonesians in Australia, compared with, if you look at, that's 60,000 people currently Indonesian and of Indonesian descent, which is tiny. I mean, Cambodia, which has less than half the population of, less than a quarter of the population of Metro Jakarta, has a bigger diaspora. So you could say, oh, well, that's because Cambodia had the war, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but 1965, Indonesia didn't have a reason for fleeing. It did, but people didn't flee. There are all kinds of reasons why Indonesia could and should have a bigger diaspora. But in fact, the diaspora relative to other countries, its size, and much, much, much smaller in Indonesia, is very, very small. This doesn't answer your question, but I just, as an observation, my thinking about that, I've thought a lot about why that might be. And I think that one thing is that for many Indonesians, the country, the nation itself, is a continent. So why do people move away from home? They move away from home either because of push factors, because they need to get away from this, for example, the very, very restrictive, constraining traditions which are going to dictate that they're going to have to drop out of school when their grandmother dies because you have to slaughter the buffalo and that's the end of the school fees, etc. So there's either the constraints that push them away, or there is opportunity. And for people in Indonesia, you can do both of those things. Get away from your own constraints and look for new opportunities without ever leaving the country. Because if you're... So, for example, the buffalo slaughter, that happens a lot in this area, for example, in Sumba. You know, the Sumbanese who actually don't want to be subject to that, don't want to be constrained by the traditions that have constrained their ancestors for generations, can go to another island, same currency, same language, same sinetron, same way of bribing the police, you know, but whole different set of opportunities and whatever. So I think there's a lot of flexibility within Indonesia to absorb people's aspirations and etc. I think that's one of the reasons that Indonesia looks more at itself than it does externally. To answer your question more precisely, right now, particularly, we have a government that is really has to concentrate. This keeping the whole place together is a massive enterprise. So the subtitle of this book, the title, Indonesia, etc., the etc. comes from the Declaration of Independence, which reads in its entirety, "We the people declare the independence of the Republic of Indonesia. The details of the transfer of power, etc., will be worked out carefully and as soon as possible." Full stop. Now, that will be 70 years ago this August, and they're still working on that etc. They're still working on finding models that will keep the country together. And that being the case, the amount of energy that you've got to spend thinking about your place in the world, your place in the bigger framework, your place in ASEAN, whatever, is very, very small, particularly with this administration, which is led by someone who is very restricted in his global view.
Can I ask a related question to this? Because with such a vast geographical area, such a diversity of culture. I mean, you've talked about in some aspects things which are quite progressive from a Western perspective, but go to the Western side and it's tribal. Is it right that it is even a nation? I mean, look, here we are, this tiny island, and we're fighting to hold the thing together at the moment with cultures that are much closer together. And it almost strikes me that somehow this stuff's been put together in a bag and held together in a bag, but it's a very weak force that's actually holding the entity together.
Yes, on the other hand, you know, this country came closer to falling apart last year than Indonesia has in the last... I mean, what force keeps the United Kingdom together? I'm not sure. Truthfully...
But that's my point, really, because we're closer in terms of culture. We've got this vast diversity. How does it stay together, and should it be one nation?
I think it is kept together largely by networks of patronage, but by a certain common interest, by a certain common history, although much of the common history is actually a narrative that was constructed at the time of independence. So you hear all the time, you know, Sukarno was forever going on about 350 years of Dutch rule, blah, blah. But in fact, you know, so here's Java. Yes, there were 350 years of Dutch rule. And up here in the Spice Islands in Maluku, 350 years of Dutch rule. Bali, which is swimming distance from Java, wasn't properly dominated by the Dutch until 1918. Aceh until the 1930s. So, you know, there was a lot of the country that hasn't even had the things that are said to hold it together. I think the ties are patronage, a.k.a. corruption, and inertia, partly. Do I think it should stay together? There's one big divide, which I think is... there's a divide here, essentially, between Papua and the rest. So this... interestingly, Timor... The country that became Indonesia at independence was what you're looking at here minus this. East Timor was not part of Indonesia at independence, and it is no longer part of Indonesia now. The area that is most culturally different, that is least integrated in any sort of culturally, systemically, whatever, is Papua. It's integrated economically because it's very, very rich, and so Java makes sure that it's got a big straw stuck into Papua and it sucks a lot out of it. But apart from that, there's very little... reason, but for the Indonesia that became a nation on either August 17th, 1947, or December 30th, 1949, depending whose narrative you follow, that Indonesia, I think, will hold together through these loose bonds of self-interest, patronage, patriotism, shared narrative. Yeah, I think it will hold together, and I don't think it needs to be much better tied down. And I think that if you tried to tie it into something that was more formal, more rigid, more fully articulated, you would create conflict, because Indonesia exists, it's almost held together, held in balance by the sum of its contradictions. That was really pompous, but do you understand what I mean by that?
I hope people are writing that down.
It's massive. It's got all of these countervailing forces, and as long as you don't actually try and articulate them, you know, they could go on kind of coexisting. If you started to say, okay, we need to, you know, be more specific about what it is that... I mean, even the relationship between the centre and the state, the two laws that govern decentralization are unbelievably opaque, not to say. I mean, they're incredibly
deliberately, partly
out of incompetence, but partly also because
it's very interesting you describe it, because Malaysia is very similar. It's also held together by some of these contradictions. Much smaller country, obviously.
Yeah, fewer contradictions, but
racially, many contradictions, religiously, some contradictions, geographically, some contradictions. Mm. Think about Sabah and the rest of Malaysia.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to this, very similar. Malaysia is a sort of small version of what you just said, and that's specific.
Yeah, the difference being that Malaysia's government, I think, tries much harder to actually manage those contradictions.
It does, but in doing so, it shines a light even more strongly on the fact that they're there.
I completely agree. I completely agree.
Whereas the Indonesians have a more enlightened approach by just sort of letting it in.
Sir?
With this huge population, it's wealthy in natural resources and agriculture. It probably punches the ball in its foot. Are you saying that it doesn't care?
Partly, yes. So let me tell you a very small story which might or might not illuminate that very large question that you've asked. So, I keep saying I was in, but so this happened in Halmahera Tengah, in a place called Weda. And Weda is, so Halmahera is basically made of nickel, essentially. And they, in Weda Bay, there's a new nickel mine opening up, and it's near a village called Lelilef. And I was staying in this village with a woman called Tessie, who's a school teacher, again, when she goes, which she didn't in the week that I stayed there. And she was complaining about how she wanted to... She was bored with her job as a school teacher, so school only runs from 7 until 1. And she wished she had more money, there's no opportunities, what could she do? I said, well, why don't you start a business? I'm like, what could I do in Lelilef? And I said, well, you know, the Eramet mine down the road is bringing in 13,000 workers over the next 9 months. And I've been staying here. There is not one place in this town where you can get anything to eat after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you could just open a little noodle stall, you know, warung. You don't need any capital, basically. And you could sell noodles to those 13,000 people who are coming in who've got nowhere to eat. And she says, Yeah. Nanti capek. That would be tiring. And I don't know if you think that answers your question at all, but I think that there is a sense of contentment, really, with Indonesia has been growing at roughly, through the Suharto year, 7%, more recently between 5 and 6% a year. A lot of that, particularly with decentralization, is trickling quite far down. And honestly, people are generally... There's a lot of moaning, but when you say, well, rather than moan, why don't you open a noodle store? Then you're like, not the capital. Yeah, and I think that's sort of true on a national level as well. I also think that one of the things that contributes to punching below its weight is the fact that it's very expensive to keep all of this together. The resources that go, both the human resources but also the financial resources that go into these patronage networks that tie things together, takes up a lot of what could, in a more efficient, homogenous, centralized country like China, be put directly back into production.
one comment I want to make is on that, you know, it's the influence of the overseas Chinese merchants, you know, through over the last century, century and a half or so. They're the ones who really, they're the ones who provide the energy, right? I mean, the virtual class of the Chinese, right, essentially. And they're the ones who are during, also during the war, because against the Japanese, but so they're the ones who sort of, you know, created trade. And they're the ones who basically sort of help keep it all this bound together by doing a lot of the work and creating a lot of commerce and those kinds of things. The locals just didn't want it because culturally, because of the type or whatever, you know. And so somebody had to come in and sort of govern them. We'll provide them the goods and services, and you know they seem to have been the Chinese who have now been there for many generations and assimilated. And then the actual sort of power base in from that emanates out of Java.
Yeah, there's something really interesting going on right now. I find absolutely fascinating. So you're quite right that you know the mercantile class has basically been Chinese since Dutch times, actually. So the Dutch had the huge plantations, etc. The Chinese did everything in the middle levels, and then the very, very small commerce was indigenous. The Chinese are now indigenous in a way, so it's a difficult distinction to make. But now you've still got state-owned enterprises, you know, where the Dutch were. Then you've got still this...
And
the Javanese. And the Javanese, yeah, fewer, but yes, exactly. Then you've got the Chinese are now taking, you know, have now built up conglomerates that are at the level of the state-owned enterprises. What's interesting is, so it used to be that in every, it still is, that in every single town in Indonesia, the shop is owned by a Chinese, etc. But, so, I've spent quite a bit of time around Sumba, and I was in Waikabuba, in the main town of Sumba, West Sumba, in 2011, every single shop in Waikabuba, bar none, every single shop was owned by Chinese, every one of them. And I went back there last November, and about 40% of the shops are now owned by indigenous, but not Sumbanese. So not Chinese, but not Sumbanese. They're owned by people from Sumbawa, who are Muslim. Sumba is largely was Christian, Protestant. So there's been this kind of invasion of small traders. This is what's happening with decentralization. It's absolutely fascinating. It's also really dangerous because there's been this bifurcation of the economy outside of Java. I'm not talking about Java, but outside of Java, what's happened is that the people who because of this patronage network that's around the civil service, the people who are from that area, putra putri daerah, which means the sons and daughters of the district, of the area, which is a phrase that I have never in my life heard. In 25 years, I never heard that phrase until about 5 years ago. And now you hear it all the time. The putra putri daerah are soaking up all the jobs that are in the civil service. They're putting on the uniform, they're going or not going to work. They're the ones who are, you know, getting all those patronage jobs. Decentralization is also bringing in a lot of money, and it's creating a lot of opportunities for very small mercantile enterprise, and those jobs are being soaked up by Indonesians from other islands. Pendatang, newcomers, outsiders. And those Pendatang are no longer only Javanese. So in eastern Indonesia, the biggest class of small traders now is actually, they use a rather dismissive term of BBM, which stands for, is the initials you use to talk about petroleum, but in this case it stands for Bugis, Buton, and Makassar. And it's the three kind of sultanates that are around South Sulawesi here and here. Very Muslim. Eastern Indonesia is largely Christian, and the people from here are now spreading out all over eastern Indonesia and taking up a lot of the role that the tiniest Chinese traders used to do are now being taken by those people. And I think that it's really interesting because as long as there's enough money for everyone, as there has been for the last few years, that means there's basically no problem. But the minute that there's some kind of a financial crisis, a shock, the money dries up, that's going to create a very, very, very visible divide between the haves and the have-nots. And that divide is going to be painted on ethnic grounds. And that's potentially very dangerous, I think.
Just changing the tack a little bit, if I may. You spent time, as you mentioned, as an epidemiologist in the country. You mentioned HIV, but that aside, what are the sort of health issues that are facing the nation at the moment?
Indonesia is one of those kind of Janus countries. It's facing both ways in the epidemiological transition, so it's still got a lot of infectious diseases and diseases of, you know, poverty and etc., but it also has a growing burden of non-communicable disease associated with rich lifestyles and whatever. That, for me, the single biggest issue is actually nutrition, malnutrition. It is unbelievable that you've got 30% nationally, nationwide, 30% of under fives are stunted in a country where you basically drop a piece of potato peel on the ground, ubi peel on the ground, and it grows into something you can eat. You know, it's the fertility, except in very few islands, is very, very high. But the malnutrition is very high, and that obviously increases your susceptibility to a whole range of other infectious and some non-infectious diseases. So that is something that ought to be quite easy to sort. So that's a major kind of underlying health issue. Part of it's really do you know? So I am really ashamed to admit this, but I worked sitting with the Ministry of Health. So yeah, I was working on sexually transmitted infections and HIV, but still, I'm an epidemiologist, I read the data. I worked for 4 years in that ministry without ever knowing this. I didn't discover this until I was trying to figure out what was going on with education in this book, and then I started looking at the nutrition stats, and I was like, Huh? I wasn't even aware of it. I started looking a little bit at it, but it'd be an ill-informed answer. Part of it is the traditions that are around childbirth. So there are a lot of traditions, particularly in Java, actually, which are trying to have a small baby. You don't want your baby to grow too big inside you. For various reasons, and it varies very much by area and whatever, but there's a certain amount of so kids are sometimes potentially like malnourished sort of when they're born from the womb. Part of it is also when I was staying with Mama Lina up in Adonara, which is off the end of Flores here, we're halfway up a volcano, and we went up, so we were eating dried fish and white rice. And after about 3 days, you know, I'm not fussy, but dried fish and white rice. But breakfast is white rice mixed with corn, and dinner is dried fish with white rice. And we're on the sides of a volcano. And then her auntie says, oh, I'm going up to the kebun, you know, to the garden, to the farm. You know, do you want to come? So I say, sure. So we go up, so we go 3 kilometers up this vertical, you know, this. I asked Susanna, the auntie, how old she was. She said, maybe 200. I don't think she was 200, but she was like in her 70s if she was a dead. She goes, not up the hill, carrying this 3-year-old baby with a bag on her head, boom, 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 trying to keep up with her. And we go up there, and she starts cutting singkong and what's that? Cassava leaves to feed to the pigs, and I said, could we have some of those for supper maybe? She was like, it's pig food. I said, yeah, but it's yummy, and she's like, oh, all right. Well, you pick the ones for us. I was like, well, you're cutting it. And she said, no, it's different. You know, if you want to pick the ones for humans, you have to have the only the ones with the green stems, not the ones with the red stems, or whatever. I got it all wrong. But so it's more of a pain to pick for human consumption, so it doesn't get done, so it gets fed to the pig. This, it's not a lack of nutritious food around. We go back down Sunday, special treat, the kids get a pack of Indomie. Indomie is instant noodles that come with a pack of flavoring, right? They open the dry Indomie, they open the flavoring, they put the flavoring on the dry Indomie and they eat it like that. That's their special treat snack for the week. That's so.
I
can't answer your question.
The nutritional problem that facing them could be related to just cultural behaviour and lack of education.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's exactly what it means. Nothing else. And cultural behaviours / idleness / yeah.
Yeah. I think we've got time for one final question.
Sorry, comment,
will my bad boyfriend treat me better in the future? Is that what you're asking? One's always hopeful about that. So I had this fight with a guy at the embassy the other night, not the fight, a very interesting discussion, because he was talking about, you know, Indonesia playing with big boys, back to Jeremy, your question about, Indonesia wanting to play in the league of China and India and this and that. And there are very few people, mostly in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that do want to. But actually, I don't think it will ever happen. I really don't. And I don't think it will happen for all the reasons that I hate about my bad boyfriend, but also for all the reasons that I love about my bad boyfriend, which is that people care more about, that there's a genuine contentment, you know, in a way, with this communal, mutually supporting, mutually helpful way of life. One thing that's really interesting is all over Indonesia, you know, I'm talking to 40 new people every day, whatever, you have the same conversation over and over and over. Where are you from? Why don't you have any children? What contraception do you use? Why don't you have it? You know, until you want to just laminate it, give it to people. But then after you get past that, you get on to the other conversation. And the other conversation all over Indonesia, except Java, is about resources, decentralization, corruption. In Java, you don't have that conversation. In Java, the conversation is about Jakarta. Don't let us become like Jakarta. Our worst nightmare, the thing we fear, is that we're going to become lolo gwegwe, which literally is Jakarta slang, and it literally means kind of, what's yours is yours, what's mine is mine, like a bit doggy dog. That's the spectre that hangs over the rest of Java. We don't want to become that selfish, driven, sinetron mediated, you know, type of society. And I thought that was really interesting. It hadn't occurred to me that that would be something that, that came up. But I think that most Indonesians actually don't want to strive hard enough to get better in terms of
better.
Yeah. So I think there is a definition of better which I would already apply to Indonesia. You know.
That was great. I'm jealous that your bad boyfriend might keep his good traits. I think my bad boyfriend might get rid of some, already getting rid of all the old historic beautiful places.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you very much. Thank you everyone for coming. Elizabeth's book is available outside, and I'm sure Elizabeth will be more than happy to sign. So yeah, let's give it a round of applause.